Metrikem. This is our series on Rabbi Soloveitchik's essay, Sacred and Profane, Kodesh and Chol in World Perspectives. Our second session together. I'm Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid and the Web Yeshiva. Thanks to all of you who sent in some interesting, insightful comments. Others sent in some provocative questions during the week. I appreciate that, and I welcome hearing from you. Those of you that are new, either those of you that are with me online now or those that are listening by archives, you know, those of you that I haven't gotten a chance to know, drop me a line. Let me know who you are, where you're from, what you're doing, what your interest in this subject is, how you got to us, your background in Jewish learning, all that kind of stuff. Many of you, of course, have been in the classes over the years and have gotten to know you, but if you've never had a chance to interact personally, please drop me a note like that so that we can talk about that. Last week we started this reading of Rabbi Soloveitchik's essay, which I mentioned is an important essay, but also an overlooked essay. He strikes themes that we've seen before. I posted for you, you received it by email, I'm sure, the famous fourth footnote to the Halachic Man. I'm not going to go through it again because we've done that together a couple of times, but if it is unfamiliar to you, it's worth reviewing. It's worth reviewing, and you'll see the degree to which it really is a very much parallel source to what he's talking about here. And he's laying out an idea of what Kiddushah is and what Chol is. And last week we spent some time trying to get to the bottom of these kinds of definitions. Chol is not exactly secular, and it's not profane, and it's not all of the other terms that we use to translate it by. There's nothing that exactly, in English, there's no concept that exactly matches one to one. That's part of the problem. We spoke about it last week. Even though, nevertheless, for convenience purposes, colloquially, we do use expressions like profane or secular to correspond to the term whole, but it's never exactly the full embodiment of the concept. It's like, you know, it's like trying to make a bed with a sheet that's too short. You can get it around three quarters, but you pull it over the fourth and it's going to pop up someplace else. There's always going to be some area where the correspondence between the word whole in Hebrew, and of course this is true for other concepts and terms in any language when rendered into a translated language, there's always going to be some kind of sacrifice that has to be made in not conveying the entirety of the concept. Here we talk about the challenge of the religious experience. We're on page 57 in our version of the essay. I did mention last week there were a few different printings of the essay, the different pagination, and different degrees of the presence of printer's errors and typos and things like that. The religious experience is beyond granting man a hedonic status of spiritual complacency. He laid out this idea, and again, I mentioned that there is a very real degree of, a very real degree of a polemic going on here with mid-century American religion. The point of religion is the religious experience is beyond granting man spiritual complacency. That you pay your dues, you pay your lip service to religion, and everything is good. We'll revisit Eov momentarily, but that idea present, at least in a simple reading of Eov, Book of Job, that Eov's worship before his suffering is the kind of thing where it's there to smooth out the wrinkles. We offer sacrifices to appease a god so that everything will be good. It's putting a kind of reserve into the bank doing mitzvot even is putting reserve into a bank to guarantee that everything will be calm and everything will be happy, that we'll have good parnasa, that our children will have shiduchim, that the business will flourish, that everyone will be happy, that no one will fight, and that there'll be good kugel at the kiddush. Or in the words of C.S. Lewis, we don't want so much a we don't want so much a father in heaven, but a grandfather in heaven. A kindly old man who'll pat us on the head at the end of the day and say, no matter what you did, it'll be all right. That notion of religion as, you know, we have a relationship with some higher power, but we want it to be a kindly power who's going to not make too many demands on us and let us get a full night's sleep. So the Rav paints a very different picture. And from a marketing perspective, I'm not sure that he's doing us any favors. To the contrary, religious experience is fraught with pitfalls and continual challenge. God, if man finds him, does not relieve the God-seeker of his imperatives, but imposes new ones. You search and search for God. This is, of course, I don't have it handy to pull off the shelf. This is, of course, the theme of his very important essay, Uvikashtem Misham, which was translated a few years ago as "And from there you shall seek him." Yeah, "And from there you shall seek him," in this series from the Torah Sarel Foundation. If anybody has Google handy, you can put up the link to Amazon, Rabbi Soloveitchik, "And from there you shall seek him," translated into English of Uvikashtem Misham, with the search for God. So you think it's like like rats in the maze. You're searching for the exit. You're searching for the piece of cheese. But at least when you're the rat in the maze and you get to the piece of the cheese, you at least have a piece of cheese. So here, that's it. Okay, somebody posted the link. Thanks. There's the link to Amazon. Oh, my goodness gracious. How could that be? It's selling for $900 on Amazon. That can't be correct. Go to the Ktav website. How in the world could it be selling for $900? One second. I'm sorry for the delay, but let's find the... Here, it's $35 on the Ktav website. KTAV.com. There, that's a link to all of the Rabbi Soloveitchik books. But why in the world, if somebody can explain to me why it should be selling for $900 on Amazon, I don't understand. Okay, maybe they just want people to buy it from their website. Anyway, so there you go. That idea that you're a rat in the maze, and you're running the maze, and you get to the end, you get to the cheese, so it's true that you had this arduous journey, but at the end you have a piece of cheese. So here, this idea that we're searching for God, and you get to God, and when you find him, it's not then you put your feet up, and you're rewarded with... with a day off. The search for God, which of course is not a literal search, it's an intellectual search. It's not searching for a place, we're searching for a level of understanding. But when you get there, more imperatives are imposed on you. The more you know, the more you have to do. Religion enriches life, gives it depth and multidimensional visions, but does not always grant man the comfort and complacency that nearly always spells superficiality and shallow-mindedness. The equation of a happy and concomitantly profound life is inadequate. The domain of sanctity is more intensely provocative and tortuous than the secular. And here he lays out his paradox, that not only does religion not smooth everything over and make you happy, it makes you not sad, but it gives you a more complex life. It gives you a more challenged life. And not challenged because religion is, it's difficult. You're a Jew in America. It's 1945 when this essay is being, written. But it's challenging, not because it's hard to do mitzvot, or not because it's hard to keep Shabbat, or you have to sacrifice in order to send your children to a Jewish school, or all the things that, that the audience reading this or hearing it when it was delivered as a lecture would have easily identified. That's not what he's talking about at all. The religious life is challenging because it's a life that requires tremendous rigor and tremendous discipline and tremendous capacity to always be mindful and engaged and deliberate. That's very demanding. The homo religiosus, this kind of archetype of the conventional religious man. This is not the religious man. This is the character that's opposed or compared to lignuto, compared to the halachic man, the true Jewish religious man, but the kind of conventional religious man, the popular religious man, is wanting in mental balance and harmony to a greater degree than a mundane type, meaning than a non-religious person. His mind sees with antinomies and antithetic problems and questions that will never find their solution. The error of modern representatives of religion is that they promise their congregants the solution to all the problems of life, an expectation which religion does not fulfill. And there's the critique on American religion. There's the critique on the promise of engagement with church and synagogue, that it will solve your problems. Right? It can't deliver the goods. It's not an opiate of the masses. On the contrary. Religion, on the contrary, it's not opium. It's coffee. It's like something that makes you edgy. It's something that, you know, that makes you like, you know, a little bit frazzled. Okay. Religion, on the contrary, deepens the problems. But here, true religion, meaning, and as he's comparing it with kind of religion as practiced and religion as what it ought to be, or in the terms of religious philosophy, religion in essence and religion in manifestation. This idea of the tensions between religion in essence, what it really is, what it really strives to be, versus how it is manifest, how it is perceived, how it is marketed and put out into the world, that's a very real tension. Religion, on the contrary, deepens the problems, but never intends to solve them. The grandeur of religion lies in its mysterium tremendum, in the great mystery. Its magnitude and its ultimate incomprehensibility. To cite one example, we may adduce the problem of theodicy. Theodicy is tzaddik v'ra lo, why the righteous suffer, the wicked prosper. The justification of evil in the world, which has tantalized the inquiring mind from time immemorial till this last tragic decade. Again, he's writing this in 1945. So the idea of why the righteous suffer is something that would have been very sharply understood by people hearing this and reading it in 1945. And it's something that, you know, in this decade of the Holocaust we just witnessed, he said, but going back time immemorial, this is a very serious question. And it's a question that we should presume religion would have something to say about. The acuteness of this problem has grown for the religious person in essence and dimensions. When a minister, rabbi, or priest, and again, it's so important to remember, his indictment of popular religion is across the board. It's not even the popular religion. It's Judaism, it's Christianity, it's Protestantism. It's all religions. It's also ours. When a minister, rabbi, or priest attempts to solve the ancient question of Eov's suffering, of Job's suffering, when you try to solve that weighty problem, that unanswerable problem, through a sermon or a lecture, he does not promote religious ends, but on the contrary, does them a disservice. When a rabbi, priest, or minister thinks that you can give easy answers to impossible to answer questions, you're really undermining religion. The beauty of religion, with its grandiose vistas, reveals itself to man not in solutions, but in problems, not in harmony, but in constant conflict of diversified forces and trends. Unhampered by theological doctrine and dogma, the Greeks, in such an understanding, could freely divinate religious faith as divine madness. Well, divine madness in the sense that you're left with questions unanswered. And we need not fear questions that cannot be answered, because some questions cannot be answered. And when religion attempts to portray itself as something that will give you all the answers, it's doing itself a disservice. It's undermining its own goals, because there are questions that cannot be answered. You're making promises, you're writing checks that cannot be covered. Now, this is an idea, he mentions here Eov, this is an idea, some answers need to remain unanswered. Dov, is that a question or a comment? A comment. Okay. And it could be that Dove comments that some questions need to remain unanswered for our own good. Period. Not question mark. But some questions remain unanswered because we do not have answers to them. I'm trying to remember the quote, another quote from C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis, that great Christian thinker in England, we know him as the author of the Narnia books, of course, but he wrote some very insightful books on popular religion. He has some very insightful things to say. We're a little poorer for the fact that we don't have a Jewish equivalent. I'm trying to remember the quote. It's a quote, something like, can there be a question that God cannot answer? So he says, something like, I should think so. There are all types of questions that can't be answered. All nonsense questions can't be answered. Is a banana more yellow or more long? Well, that's a nonsense question. So the only answer to a nonsense question is there is no answer. So when a child asks a nonsense question, we can't answer him because there's no answer to it. But the child doesn't know that his question is a nonsensical question. So many of our questions are like that. To God, they must appear as nonsensical questions, but we don't perceive them as such. But then there are questions that are real questions. The question of theodicy, the question of tzadik v'ra'lo, why the righteous suffer, well, that is a real question. But we have no answer to it. The Rav, in his very important essay, Kol Dodido Fake, translated as, it's two different two different translations of it. Hold on. Here. Ah, only $14. That's good. Cold will be the fake. Listen, my beloved Knox. Here's the link to it on Amazon. It's something that I thought we should, add to our curriculum. Cold will be the fake was a speech that the Rav gave, and then later it was written up. It was given in the 50s, and it's his fullest treatment of the topic of religious Zionism. But before he gets to that topic of religious Zionism, he talks about Eov, and it's his fullest treatment also of the Holocaust and the events of history. I think it was in the early mid-1950s. He makes a point about Eov, that the question of why the righteous suffer, or why anyone suffers, for that matter, what any type of suffering, what's the role of suffering in the world, why a just God would have a world in which suffering can take place, it's a spiritually distracting question. At the end of the day, God's answer to Eov is, you have no idea how and why I run the world the way I do, and I am not inclined to let you know about all of the secrets. I do not have to, says God. These are my words, not God's actual words to Eov in the book, but they're the force of them. I do not need to let you behind the scenes to understand the mechanics of how I run the world. There are certain things which we cannot understand. Lo machshavotai machshavotechem. God's way of understanding things, God's mind is closed off to us to a very real degree. The question of why this should be, why the righteous should suffer, is spiritually distracting, says the Rav, because it takes our eye off the ball. It distracts us from the work that we're meant to do in this world, which is not to search for answers to questions which we cannot find answers to, but to alleviate suffering, to comfort the miserable, to take care of the orphan and the widow, etc., etc. And the whole attempt to philosophize about it takes away some of the focus that we might have on actually alleviating suffering in this world. But the question itself is left as a taku. It's unresolved. What is the point of all of this? Let's now ask, he says this idea that religion is about questions, it's about challenges, it's about conflicts, it's about being presented with ideas that, with difficult ideas that we can't get always satisfactory answers to. It's not about still waters and green pastures and families that pray together, stay together, and about solving all of society's ills and making sure your children don't go off the path and making sure that nobody does drugs and making sure you're happily married and all those things. It's about a life of question and challenge. So what is the point of all of that? The ideal of Greek ethics was the harmonious personality, the balanced man, the complete proportionate nature. Aristotle, Aristotelian psychology, at the top of page 58, and ethics derived from this ideal. Even as a physician, Aristotle analyzed sickness and disharmony and disturbance of proportion. However, the history of culture will attest in many instances that the creative geniuses of humanity have not always been harmonious personalities. Creation springs from primordial chaos. Religious profundity springs from spiritual conflict. The Jewish ideal of the religious personality is not the harmonious individual determined by the principle of equilibrium. but the torn soul and the shattered spirit that oscillate between God and the world. In this substrata of spiritual experience, the religious man endures constantly the diastrophic forces of mental upheaval and psychic collision. Mental upheaval, psychic collision, a torn soul, a shattered spirit, primordial chaos, spiritual conflict. I mean, could you imagine anybody trying to attract people to a worldview like this? And could you imagine anyone trying to do this in 1945? It's astounding. It's just amazing. There's no doubt that the religious worldview that he's describing, and let's be clear, this is not the unanimous interpretation of the Jewish worldview, although Rabbi Soloveitchik was certain that he was correct on this. To be clear, this is not the Hasidic and certainly not the neo-Hasidic worldview of what Judaism is, what Judaism is all about. And to be clear, he's probably describing something more about himself. He's much more explicit. He's much more explicit on this point in The Lonely Man of Faith, where he says explicitly that, you know, he only really knows his own inner life, his own inner spiritual religious life. Anybody can only ever intimately know their own personal inner spiritual life. And he's going to describe something if it relates to you, if you recognize something about yourself in the typology that he's painting, The Lonely Man of Faith, The Lonely Man of Faith being the most autobiographical work, more so than Halachic Man. It's a mistake when people refer to Rabbi Soloveitchik as the Halachic Man. He was the Lonely Man of Faith. That was the character that he portrayed that was much more an autobiographical projection. And here, it's the same idea. It's kind of the inner struggle that we have to work out and to live with some of the struggle. The idea that's part of it. That's, you know, what Heraclitus, the Greek philosopher, said, that you know, everything in life comes about through conflict. The conflict is the source of creativity. Because everything is always in flux. Heraclitus is the same one that says, you can never step into the same river twice. And his student said, you can never even step into the same river once. Because once you've stepped into it, it's not the same river. Because it's constantly flowing, it's constantly moving, there's constant tension, constant movement, constant change. Moshe sees the burning bush. On the one hand, he covers his face in apprehension. He would escape the awesome sight. Yet on the other, some mysterious invisible force fascinates him, irresistibly draws him near, and he says to the great silence, Asura na ve'ere etamare hagadol hazeh, madua lo yivar hasne. I will draw near and see this wondrous sight. He sees this kind of miraculous, the bush is burning, it's not consumed. He turns from the path, the kind of straight and easy and narrow. The easiest thing is always to stay on the path, to keep moving lockstep, one foot after the other. But he's perplexed. He asks himself the question, Madua, what's the cause of this? What is this all about? And he turns from the easy path to make an investigation. And because of that, his own life is altered. Jewish history is altered. World history is altered. This is not harmony, and this is not the balanced attitude of the Stoic philosopher. It is rather the ideal of a personality torn between two powerful poles of fear and hope, dread and love. And is not the history of Israel a panorama of fluctuations? Flight from God and then return. The exodus from Egypt, the revelation, the golden calf, the erection of the temple, the episode of the spies, and later in the age of the prophets, the constant alternation of serving God and deserting him. Up and down, repair and destruction. I presume this is a typo or a mistranslation or something that crept into the text, I'm not sure where, it says the erection of the temple, it surely means the Mishkan, the tabernacle, it should say, not the Beit HaMikdash. Here on page 58, should cross out temple and substitute tabernacle or Mishkan. So the entire story, yeah, maybe. Although I think, like I said, I don't have a copy of it. It's not widely available. The essay, I think, was originally published in Hebrew. So yeah, so maybe transcribing from tapes or who knows what, could have easily said Mishkan and Mikdash could have easily been. Whether it was in Yiddish or in Hebrew or the translator, whether the mistake was in the Hebrew, and then we have to look into what the provenance of the essay is. I'm not sure exactly how it all got written up. So the entirety of Jewish history that he just outlined, it's up and down, it's back and forth, ratzov v'shov, up and down, and repair and destruction and redemption and calamity. It would appear that the supreme religious experience of revelation did not suffice to grant full security and religious contentment to Bnei Israel. For they sinned while yet in the desert, while yet still in the shadow of Har Sinai. Right? So that religion, here, the greatest religious moment in history, the revelation on Mount Sinai, didn't solve all the problems, did it? As a matter of fact, right there, but a number of days later, the golden calf. And not only that, but as he now lays out in the hazards of Kedusha, let's try to finish up with this next section, that sometimes religion itself is the source of the problem. It's the source of the problem because religion sometimes gets perverted. But beyond that, the bigger they are, the harder they fall, the more Kedusha is a very powerful idea. And just like fire has the power to warm and to cook and to heal, it also has the power to burn and destroy. That's part of the message of the Chet HaEgel, the sin of the golden calf. It wasn't mere idolatry. It was an idolatrous consequence that came about through a desire for holiness, but a misdirected one. The hazards of Kedusha, the hazards of holiness. It's an empirical fact that Kedusha elevates man, not by vouchsafing him harmony and synthesis, balance and proportionate thinking, but by revealing to him the non-rationality and insolubility of the riddle of existence. And here's the line. This is, you know, if the essay was published as a book, this would be the jacket blurb. Kedusha is not a paradise, but a paradox. Again, Kedusha is not a paradise, but a paradox. The dangers involved in the realm of Kedusha are by far more hazardous than those predicated in the secular sphere. And he lays out the idea. And in typical fashion, he does so relying on the halachic worldview, on the halachic code, on the halachic material, as exemplars of the philosophical idea that he's laying out. This interpretation of Kedusha is reflected in the halachic code. The halacha requires of man a more vigilant attitude in regards to Kedusha than to Chol. In other words, I might think there's the world of Kedusha and there's the world of Chol. There's the world of mitzvot and the world that's neutral to mitzvot. Obviously, there's also a world of sin. But not everything is mitzvah or sin. Not everything is asur or mutar. On the contrary, this is one of the problems that we make, that halachic Jews make. That beyond the world of Isser the Heter, there's the realm of right and wrong. This is a debate in theology and philosophy, Rabbi Lichtenstein, the Rav's son-in-law, has an important essay entitled, Does Judaism Recognize an Ethic Independent of the Halakha? Is there an ethical realm independent of halakhic thought? Or is halakhic thought ipso facto the parameters of halakha? So I'll suggest that beyond the, whatever your answer to that question is, beyond the commonly understood realms of iser v'heter, of prohibited and permitted, the kinds of dinim one finds in the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch or books written by Art Scroll, there's a realm of right and wrong. And that's important not to forget. I'm going to come back to that in a second because it'll take us off on a sidetrack, but I'm going to come back, let me put a pin in that part of the conversation. So we might think that the realm of mitzvot, so mitzvot themselves are holy, but the realm of chol, of secular, so that's where you really need guardrails. That's where you really need protective fences. No, quite the contrary. Laws like, and now he brings a list of halachic concepts, some of them from the temple service. Tumah, Hesech Hadat, Pigul, Notar, Yotzei. These are all in the footnote. The editor gives you thumbnail definitions of each. But Tumah, of course, is the realm of ritual purity and impurity, so essential in the days of the Beit HaMikdash, where sacrifices had to be offered, things had to be pure, people had to be pure. This involved various processes of remaining pure or attaining ritual purity. This is not clean and dirty, but a kind of ritual purity. There are all types of things in the world that can distance you from ritual purity to larger or lesser extents, and the manner in which we return to a state of being ritually pure, which allows us to engage in the temple service, which allows us to eat sacrifices, kohanim, the priests have separate or independent requirements in this regard because of the role they play in the Beit HaMikdash, etc., etc., etc. The major source of tumah, of impurity, is death, is proximity to a dead body, but other forms of impurity come about through contact with other impure things. Kedusha, tahara, purity, is very vulnerable. And the whole realm of tumah, of impurity, proves just how vulnerable it is. Hesech Hadat, a kind of mental distraction, which is problematic halachically in the temple service, in the sacrificial order, but even in, think of the discussions we had about Kavanah a few months ago, Kavanah, intent in prayer. So Hesech Hadat, distraction, is a requirement that's enacted particularly in the realm of the holy. Pigul, notar, yotzei, these are all invalidations in korbanot. Pigul and notar are time invalidations. In a moment he's going to discuss the holiness of time and the holiness of place, so I'll come back to these ideas, but briefly, pigul and notar means sacrifices that we're allowed to consume, sacrifices that we're allowed to eat from, have to be eaten within certain deadlines. So one who sacrifices an animal with the intention to eat it after the deadline, that animal is pigul. You cannot eat it. It's invalid. And notar is you sacrificed it with the proper intentions, but for whatever reason they were leftovers. And after the deadline has passed, you can't eat the sacrifice. Yotzei, certain sacrifices have to be eaten in certain places, inside the temple, inside Jerusalem, etc. If it's removed from its sacred place, it becomes invalid, it becomes forbidden to eat. All these types of guardrails around sanctity indicate how vulnerable sanctity is, how hazardous it is. All of these requirements and many others that affect only the sacred, not the profane, indicate the halachic view that kedusha can be easily corrupted. Kedusha intrinsicates shmira. Anything that is holy requires vigilance, requires guarding, continual and total awareness and diligence, lest man fall from his high estate. Moreover, religion, if corrupted through amoral applications, turns volte-face, about face, 180 degrees, and becomes a negative destructive force. That religion, when corrupted through amoral applications, becomes a very, very negative destructive force. Beyond a chilul Hashem, desecrating God's name, which it certainly also constitutes. Sadly, one only need open any newspaper to marshal copious examples of amoral applications of religion, things that are done in the name of religion. I don't mean, you know, there's a rabbi. Maybe you've heard of such things. There's a rabbi, and he looks like a rabbi, and he's got that kind of rabbinic beard and that rabbinic hat and that rabbinic name. And he did something wrong, something illegal, something immoral, something repugnant, something criminal. Maybe you've heard that this once happened. So that's a chilul Hashem. It's a desecration of God's name. And it's a terrible thing. And the person should be punished, and the police should come, and they should arrest him, and he should go to jail for however long he has to go to jail. And if people try to defend him when he's really guilty, so they're also no good. It doesn't mean that everybody that's accused of something is guilty. On the contrary, sometimes good people are accused of all types of things that they're innocent of, and they should be defended. But sadly, often the case is that they're accused of things that they're actually guilty of. That's a chilul Hashem. He's talking here about something that's even more profoundly disturbing. Using religion for amoral purposes. And then it becomes a negative destructive force. When the golden calf, here he quotes a midrashic idea, I'm not certain that the footnote is correct. The footnote cites the Pirkei Rav Eliezer. I tried searching for this. I couldn't find the exact reference that I was referring to. But there's this midrashic idea that the golden calf was inscribed with Yudkei Vavkei, that God's holy name, that holy name which is so holy we don't even pronounce it, was inscribed onto the golden calf. It became a negative force, not merely a neutralized force, wreaking havoc in the Jewish camp. The misuse, the amoral use of religion is what really creates the destruction. We have witnessed how the corruption of great ideals gave birth to evil forces in religious and ethical impregnation, more dangerous than evil fathered by evil. Love, so here are the examples. I'll come back to the chapter in a second. Love, the exalted concept of religion, was distorted into the persecution of heretics. That is a swipe at Catholicism. The dignity of man, the lofty concept of the humanists, was transformed into the deification of man and the worship of the dictator. That is a swipe at communism. The spiritual concept of the state reemerged into the fascist corporate state and to the consequent nothingness of the individual. That's a swipe at Nazism. I should make a point that this concern for the individual is something that's very, it's a trademark of Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought. It's one of the ways in which Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought differs from that of Rav Kook, for example. Religious Zionist thought, particularly religious Zionist thought in Eretz Yisrael, occupied itself much more with an analysis of, discussion of, the collective. Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought, and existentialist thought in general, was much more focused on the individual. Kedusha entails horta v'lidata b'kedusha. Here is using a metaphor, a reference to Gemara Ketubot, but the context of the Gemara is not relevant for our conversation. Maybe the kedusha requires from A to Z, from beginning to end, vigilance and awareness, diligence. The conception and fruition of the divine concept and the constant awareness of sanctity. The halakha is prescient to the fact that pitfalls are present in religious values. It presupposes that kedusha involves both positive challenges and negative forces. It is aware that the struggle and challenge lie not in the seeking of religious values, but in their keeping. This, then, is the halakhic conception of the states of Kodesh and Chol. Chol is not evil. Chol is not sin. In that way, the term profane, because of its connotations of the pejorative, of the negative, are imprecise. Chol just means common, everyday. Like the example I gave last year, you want a hamburger? Bakasha. That's called chulin. You have to slaughter the cow. The meat has to be drained and salted of its blood. You have to prepare it in a kosher way. But it's chulin. It's common. It's not a ritual to eat the hamburger. You want to eat korbanot. You want to eat sacrifices in the time of the Beit HaMikdash. That's kadosh. And it's going to come with all types of superimposed requirements to safeguard the kedusha. But a hamburger is just a hamburger. It's whole. So this idea that kodesh, that the holiness requires greater requirements, is the idea that he's getting at. Let me just look at the chat for a minute. I'm going to come back to something I started before. Oh my goodness! Thank you very much, Peter. Peter's great. Peter's like, you know, each class we have like one of these like a teacher's assistant. You know, like I say something, and before I can finish saying it, somebody's linked to it. So Peter, I was unaware that this was available online. This important paper on the Jewish tradition recognizing ethic independent of halakha is online with a few responses to it by people that are working today in Jewish philosophy. I don't know anything about these responses. I can't vouch for them. But Rabbi Lichtenstein's essay is certainly well worth reading. Apparently, here from here, you can download it as a PDF. So I recommend that heartily. I want to come back to this idea that I mentioned earlier, that beyond the realm, and it's actually relevant to that reference throughout Rabbi Lichtenstein's essay, beyond the realm of Isser v'Heter, of pure, you know, Ifim in the Shulchan Aruch, there's a whole different realm of right and wrong. I always think of the following example. Since ours is a religion of the law, a religion of halakha, we overlook the primacy of the realm of ethics, or historically it's happened from time to time that there are trends in which the primacy of ethics are overlooked or sidetracked. So take the following example. Rabbeinu Gershom, Or HaGola, here he is, Rabbeinu Gershom, who was the leading lived in the 11th century, before Rashi. In Ashkenaz, famously made a certain number of takanot, a certain number he instituted certain bans or certain requirements. Most famously, his was the ban that removed polygamy as a halachic option. You know in the Torah that polygamy is technically permitted, and we have a number of well-known cases of men who are married to more than one woman. Although, even a casual perusal of the Chumash and the Tanakh will show you that it does not seem to have been an everyday occurrence. Most men only had one wife. But there were examples of men who had more than one wife, and technically speaking, according to the Torah, one is allowed to be married to more than one woman at a time. This was never a very common practice. It seems to have already been very rare in the times of Chazal. And in Europe, in the Middle Ages, even rarer still. Rabbeinu Gershom made a takana, an injunction that forbids it. And today, although technically permitted by the Torah, polygamy has long been outside of the mainstream of any stream Jewish practice. He made a few other takanot. One of the famous ones is that it is forbidden to read other people's mail, or other people's private papers. According to Rabbeinu Gershom, you're not allowed to sneak a peek at someone's diary or at a letter that was sent to them. Now, I always think of this as a very tragic fact. Does the Torah anywhere say, or does the Talmud anywhere say, you're not allowed to sneak a peek at someone else's private diary? You're not allowed to hack into someone's email. I'm not talking about the NSA now. You're not allowed to hack into someone else's email and read their emails. In other words, this happens all the time. Someone says, oh, can I borrow your computer for a second? Sure, go ahead. And by accident, they forget to log out. So after they've left your house, or after they've left your computer at the cafe, their Gmail is still there. And you see, some very scintillating subject line, that they got a message from someone. You're tempted to read it. All you have to do is click a button. Does the Torah forbid that? No. You know what? You cannot point to a verse in the Torah or to a single Mishnah that outlaws it. So Rabbeinu Gershom made a takana. He closed that loophole and said it is forbidden to do that. Now, why is that a tragedy? I always think it's a tragedy because anyone that knows anything at all about Torah and mitzvot, anyone that knows anything at all about what God wants of us anyone that knows anything at all about the spirit of the law knows that you're not supposed to do this, that holy people would not do this. But because ours is a system of law, you can't point to a verse or to a Mishnah or to a line in the Shulchan Aruch and say, aha, there it is, black on white forbidden. And because no system of law, no matter how comprehensive, can actually ever get around to listing chapter and verse every single possible iteration of every single possible case, there are going to be lacunae, things that are left unlegislated, things that we need to fall back on our, as Rabbi Twersky, Zichrono Lebracha, Rabbi Soloveitchik's other son-in-law once put it, our halachic antennae, that we're supposed to develop halachic antennae that give us the sensitivity to navigating in cases that aren't legislated black and white. So I always think the day that Rabbeinu Gershom had to actually get up and state the obvious, that you're not allowed to read other people's mail. It's a tragedy. You should tear Kriya. Anybody with eyes in their head, anybody that knows anything at all about what the Torah wants of us should know that such behavior is repugnant. But since it was technically never specifically legislated, so you're left with this loophole that has to be closed. That's this realm of the beyond Isser Veheter, is the realm of right and wrong. And Kedusha, part of a life of Kedusha, is developing those halachic antennae, being able to intuit what's demanded of us, even outside of the kinds of specific limits of the black and white letter of the law, but to imbibe the spirit of the law as well is part of this accessing the life of Kedusha. The next section, which we'll turn to next week, starting on the bottom of page 59, is this section 2 or chapter 2. These divisions of the essay into different sections was something I think that the editors put in. Peter points out this was part of the great occupation of the Musar movement, as a kind of corrective to the legalistic excesses of particularly Lithuanian, Eastern European Talmud study. So place consciousness, the idea that holiness in Judaism is an idea that's rooted in place and in time, is something that we have to understand, and that's where we'll pick up. So if you're able to continue reading for next week, we will continue